Welcome to the 2018 Bay Area Book Festival. This is Sherilyn Parsons, founder and director of the festival. Enjoy the conversation.
Well, welcome. This is the second day of the fourth year of the Bay Area Book Festival, and I'm delighted to welcome you here. If you haven't already silenced your phone or pager, please do so now. We do not like to hear phones ringing in the middle of a session. I want to acknowledge the sponsorship of the Consulate General of Canada of San Francisco and Silicon Valley. They've been very generous. I actually met the woman who arranged it, and she's very charming, very Canadian. There will be a book signing by all three authors at the conclusion of the session. It's going to be through these back doors into the courtyard. That's where their books are located. So our topic today is the political power of the novel. And the most recent works by these three authors all demonstrate that in very powerful ways. But the three books have a lot more in common than that. They're all historical novels, delving into the history of the Chinese Revolution, Che Guevara's guerrilla war in Bolivia, and race relations in the American South. All three novels feature strong women protagonists. They're all portraits of families living in turbulent times. And all three stories unfold over several decades. So any student of comparative literature would have a field day with these three novels. Our three panelists are Margaret Wilkerson Sexton, immediately to my left, Rodrigo Hasbun, who is in the middle, as you can probably determine, and Madeline Teen. Their bios are available on the festival website, and I assume that you have read those. So I'm not going to bore you by reading those and taking up time. Instead, I'd like them to introduce themselves briefly and relate something that is not in their published bios on the website. You want to start, Margaret?
Sure, I'll start. Thank you guys for being here. It's such a treat to be able to talk with people in my hometown. I've been traveling to festivals for months, and it's so nice to just have driven 10, 15 minutes to get here and to see all of you. So let's see, something that's not in my bio. I grew up in New Orleans. I was born there, and I lived there until I was 12. And when I was 12, my mother moved us to Bethel, Connecticut. And it was the community we lived in within Bethel was a very working class, blue collar, very white community. And I had gone to an all black school in New Orleans, and it was quite a culture shock. And I hadn't thought about this before. I've been thinking about it lately, but I really think a lot of the seeds for what my work has come to be were planted in that small town in Bethel, Connecticut when I was 12, because I was one of four black children in a school of 800 people and 800 kids. And there was just quite a bit of racism. Even at such an early age, there was so much of the beginnings of what we see now in this country to be the racial framework. There was so much of that. It wasn't on a smaller scale because it was identical to what we're seeing now, but it was just being enacted in smaller bodies. And I think so much of the dynamics of that have shaped who I've come to be and what I've come to write about and how I view the world. I've just been thinking about it lately because it was only 2 years. I was there for 2 years and then I went to a boarding school. And even though the boarding school was predominantly white, there was a very strong black community there and we were very insulated in that way. But those 2 years were very significant for me personally, and they have, when I think about it, they really are symbolic of what's going on in the country right now on a whole.
Oh, thank you, Margaret. Rodrigo.
Well, thank you all for being here. Bios usually focus on the stuff you've succeeded in, and so I'll talk a little bit about a couple of things I failed at, which are as defining, right? Or maybe even more defining than the other stuff. So I've widely failed at becoming a musician. That's what I would really wanted to be. I gave it a shot for 5 or 6 years, and it didn't happen. So I ended up becoming a writer almost as a consolation. And another thing I failed at is staying at the place where I was born, which is something my best friends have done and my family mostly has done. So I've been traveling around in the last 15 years. I've lived in 5 different countries, and I live now in Houston, Texas. Another country. Well, we were talking about this, and Houston is less Texan than you would imagine. You know? So I failed at that too, and those two things have been have had a huge impact, I think, in who I am and also in my writing.
Mm-hmm. Maddie?
Thanks. It's such a funny height. I'm just going to have to go like this. I grew up in Vancouver in Canada, so just up the coast.
You need to be closer.
Louder? I actually might take it off. Does it come?
It's a little hard.
Better. Is that better?
Yeah.
Excellent. Something that's not in my bio, when I was 7, 6, my parents put us all in their van and we drove from Vancouver to California. That was my first visit to California to go to Disneyland. And on the way back, I really, really loved the music of John Denver as a child. And my parents were picking up necessities and I was clutching this cassette of John Denver in my hand and I put it in my pocket. I didn't mean to shoplift it. I was just holding on to it, and I forgot about it, and I stole it. And I remember when we crossed the border, I was so terrified that we would be stopped for this John Denver cassette, and I would be permanently separated from my family. But we made it across. I now teach at CUNY at Brooklyn College. It just started, so it's the first time I've actually lived in the United States. And it's been a pretty intense adjustment. There's been a lot to learn.
Hey, thank you, Maddie. I'm going to start asking questions of the authors. We're going to get to Q&A fairly soon, I hope. For Margaret, your publisher describes A Kind of Freedom as an urgent novel that explores the legacy of racial disparity in the South through a poignant and redemptive family history. But that's not how I read the book. Surely there were overt changes in the Jim Crow regime over the 7 decades during which the story unfolds, and that represents progress of a sort. But Jim Crow lives on in the present day in the lives of Evelyn and Jackie's family. And I don't see redemption in the decline of the family over the years from the household of the first black doctor in Louisiana to a great-grandson in prison for growing marijuana. Am I missing the point?
No. No. I think I would agree with you, to be honest. You don't want to end a book on a really, really dark note. I mean, I didn't want to. And so I do feel that... let me back up. So the book spans 3 generations of a New Orleans family, and... It starts at the height of World War II and ends in post-Katrina New Orleans. And so there are 3 families, there are 3 generations represented through a grandmother, her daughter, and then her grandson. And the grandmother is this very well-to-do Creole woman. Her father's a doctor, and she goes to debutante balls, and she has a very polished, sheltered life. And as we go forward chronologically, the family regresses in many ways in terms of social standing, economic stability, and even familial safety, I would say, or familial security. So we end up with the grandson in in post-Katrina New Orleans who's in jail for selling drugs. And so it's supposed to be ironic. I mean, you would expect the family to do better over time because, of course, Jim Crow has been abolished and we've made so much progress. And we have made progress in some ways. But I wanted to highlight this the ways in which we haven't made progress and the pockets of the African American community that are in some ways degenerating because of the systemic structures that have come in to do the work of Jim Crow in its place, like mass incarceration and the war on drugs. So no, I intended for the book to end, you know, that's my thesis, that we have systemic structures doing the work for Jim Crow. And so I intended to show that. And personally, you know, I want the character to do well. You know, I don't want to give away anything. I personally want the character to do well, and I leave that window open at the end.
Yes.
But I want to show the damage that's been done, and I want to honor the damage that's been done in the country. So it would be unrealistic, and I think it would be undermining the damage if I end it with, like, you know, oh, everything's great, and, you know. So I think, yeah. I think you took it the way I meant it.
Great. Well, that's very reassuring. Okay, Rodrigo. Affections is a fictionalized account of the lives of Hans Ertel and his three daughters in Bolivia, where he fled after World War II. Ertel was Rommel's personal photographer and a cameraman for Leni Riefenstahl's Nazi propaganda movies. His eldest daughter, Monica, joined Che Guevara's revolution and ultimately became his avenger by assassinating the man who ordered the amputation of Che's hands as proof of his death. You've researched all the available information about the Ertel family. Can you understand how Leni Riefenstahl's cameraman could father Che Guevara's avenger? It's hard to imagine a generation gap more extreme than that.
Yeah. Most of my most progressive friends grew up in incredibly conservative families. So I think that's an extreme example of that was the case of the Yerolds. There's a huge generational gap, and there's a collision, a struggle between affects and ideology. And I was very interested in that and how much can you love or keep loving someone you disagree with in very basic and structural stuff. Regarding the question, I think that's the question I'm trying to ask in the novel. How did this girl become who she became? And I'm not offering an answer.
No,
I think
no.
There are many possible answers on the way. But I wasn't interested in the answers. I was extremely interested in asking the question. No, how did she become who she became? And there are many things there. She was strong-willed, as her dad was. She was very rebellious, and that's something her father loved about her until she rebelled against him. And that was also very interesting. She had a failed marriage to a rich man. So she was part of the Bolivian aristocracy. And she gave up that life because I think she was young and she was aware of how messed up the country was at the time. And she was aware of the racial and economic and political issues that the country had. They arrived in Bolivia in 1953. That's a year after the nationalistic revolution.
Yes.
And until then, the indigenous population, who was the great majority of the population, they weren't allowed to vote, for instance. Women were not allowed to vote. And the colonial legacy in the country was very present. So she couldn't stand it, and as many other young people in the 60s, in the 50s and 60s, try to do something about it.
Yes, yes. Thank you. Maddie, your latest novel, Do Not Say We Have Nothing, explores the history of China from the years just before the declaration of the People's Republic through the famine and turbulence of the Great Leap Forward and the Cultural Revolution to the shock of Tiananmen Square and beyond. You've obviously gained an intimate knowledge of those events, yet your parents are from Hong Kong and Malaysia, and you were born in Vancouver. It's hard to believe you learned all that history from books. Where does it all come from?
Sorry. I'll answer in two halves. Some of that came from about 5 or 6 years of wandering very nomadically in China, trying to absorb what was around me, before me, what was visible and invisible. And in a place where history is very contested, there is official history, and then there's the world of unofficial history. And I think a large part of my relationship with China came from another place that I became very attached to, which was Cambodia. I had spent 5 years writing about the Cambodian genocide and the Cambodian civil war. And it left me with a lot of very difficult questions about human nature, about amnesia, about the ways we are all implicated in massively destructive forces that we play out in other countries. And it also made me ask really difficult questions about the nature of literature and the necessity of words failing when up against certain catastrophic political and historical events. And so that's what I brought into Do Not Say We Have Nothing. I had big questions about what is the nature of revolutionary language? What does it ask of our best selves? And what does it tap into in our worst selves? And that Do Not Say We Have Nothing is, I think, a lot about music. The three characters at the center are all musicians, and one of them is a composer. And I wanted to look at the forms of language and expression and art in which we try to find a way through this unspoken, unarticulated, unofficial history and gather these pieces that we try to hold on together to in the face of, in this case, a totalitarian regime.
Okay, so I knew none of that. Knew none of that history of yours. Interesting. Margaret, Rodrigo, does either of you have any questions for Maddie, or any comments on what she said? or Maddie, do you have any comments on what Margaret or Rodrigo said? Or you know, around the
table? I was wondering about the John Denver cassette. Do you still have it?
My dad, who loves Elvis and John Denver, he passed away. He told me I had really large ears and that I had John Denver ears. And so all through my childhood, I was this like little Asian kid that my family all called John Denver.
Okay. Well, Margaret, back to you. You wrote an article for Oprah.com about meeting and living with your husband, who is white. You comment about the racism you encountered when the two of you were living and working in the Dominican Republic, just as the characters in your novel experience racism in the contemporary U.S. South. I gather that you now live in the Bay Area, in Oakland. So we pride ourselves here in this area on being more diverse and more open-minded than the rest of the country. Have you found that to be the case?
Okay. That's such a great question. It's a big question. I think about it a lot. It's funny. It's something I've been thinking about a lot lately because I find myself in New Orleans all the time for various reasons. And I'm always a little bit on edge when I'm headed to the South. It's just like I think it's just a primitive thing. You know, I grew up in the South and I had I had fewer issues when I actually lived in the South than I've had in other parts of the country, but it's just like, even still, I have the messaging that the South is what we're supposed to be afraid of, and of course we know how they vote and all of that. So whenever I go to the South, I'm just on edge, but the truth is I don't have any problems in New Orleans. New Orleans, in some ways, like you were saying about Houston, is not quite Louisiana. You know, New Orleans is a really special city in the state. But, I mean, it's hard to say. I spend more of my time here. So, you know, if I were to encounter problems, just proportionately, more of them would, it would make sense that more of them would happen here. And it's very subtle. And I think that's what I'm going to speak about. It's just, it, what I notice here is that everything is very subtle. And it's almost, sometimes you don't notice it until later. You think about something and you're like, oh, that was definitely racial. You know, maybe it wasn't racist, but it was definitely racial. I know that certain assumptions are made. I think that sometimes when I'm with my husband, I notice that people talk to him. He's a white male. People talk to him in a different way than they talk to me. That's not something that any of us could even, I mean, it could even dispute, because it makes perfect sense because of what we know about how white males, about the power dynamic between white males and other demographics in this country. And it's not to, to cause anybody to feel guilt. It's just what we know about the country and the dynamics. And so, yeah, there's a lot of subtle stuff like that. One thing I find really interesting is that in the South, you see a lot more. It's not quite forced, but it's mandatory integration, because there are so many more Black people, and so many more Black people are in certain demographics in society. So, for instance, because of HBCUs, you have a lot of educated Black people in the South, and so when you go into a building where where lawyers work in downtown New Orleans, you're going to see all the races there represented. You're going to see a lot of Black people there. I don't see that as much outside of the South, and I think because of that, I think it encourages a lot of stereotypes to flourish outside of the South. So, for instance, in San Francisco, where I lived for many years, it's unusual to see Black people with white people there, or even Black people a lot in San Francisco, especially now. And I think it's interesting, because San Francisco seems to be such a progressive place, but if you don't have races intermingling and dealing with each other, it can't be that progressive, because you're not having the educational interactions that that encourage and influence change. So I just think about that kind of stuff, like how in the South you just have more of that. You know, you have more, you're going to walk down the hall and you're going to see the Black lawyers, you're going to see the white lawyers, and they're going to be eating in the same restaurants, and you're not going to go to a restaurant and all of the people serving you are Black. And that's pretty unusual in New Orleans. But here, you know, I see some of that, and I see a lot of subtle slights, and I think it's just because of lack of exposure to all sorts of demographics of Black people. And I think also this is the last thing I'll say, because I could talk about this forever, but there's a pride that I see in the Bay Area around not being racist. And I think that's great. But I think it also kind of insulates you from the ways in which you are racist. Like, you know, like, yeah. I think people think because they're not, you know, doing the most egregious things that are happening in the South, that they're not entertaining certain belief systems that are also contributing to the mass, you know, collective consciousness of racism in the country. And we all have this. This is all part of our collective unconscious, in my opinion. And so it would be silly for any of us to deny that we have it, because we all have it. We all have stereotypes and everything. Even within our own communities, we have this. Yeah. And so I think, yeah, sometimes even in my own family, like my brother-in-law will say, like he asked me, did you notice in the South that people were less eager to hear about the ideas in your book? And I was like, no, they weren't. I mean, I think you want to think that they were, but they weren't. So that's what I think about that.
Thank you. Rodrigo. You've clearly given your life over to writing now, after having failed as a musician.
Thank you for the reminder.
you have two novels and a collection of short stories in print, and you've been named one of the 20 best writers in the Spanish language under the age of 35. I confess I'm not familiar with your other novel or your short stories, but Affections is deeply political. The inequality and injustice that pervades Bolivian society is powerfully revealed. Do you consider yourself to be political? Are you directly involved as an activist in anything political?
I would like to give you a little bit of context on how Bolivian literature has been written traditionally or historically. Writers were usually politicians, or they had political ambitions, and I grew up reading that literature and kind of hating it, because I felt that they wanted to instruct me, they wanted to convince me, they wanted my vote, and I didn't feel that they were doing what literature can do. They weren't taking advantage of the powers of literature. So when I was becoming a writer, one thing I knew is that I didn't want to be that kind of writer. So in terms of what role I played in society, but also in terms of what was I aiming to do with my books and what kind of stories I was telling. And for instance, Bolivian literature is very invested in exploring the public spaces. And one of my reactions to that, one of my rebellions against that, was to explore intimacy and see what was going on in intimacy, and what were the power dynamics or the racial dynamics or gender dynamics within family relationships or within couples, etc. I'm saying all that because in Bolivia I'm considered the least political writer, the least political Bolivian writer. They're like, oh, he's not writing about politics. And I am, but I'm doing it through a different lens. Uh-huh. But the thing is that when my books started to get translated into other languages, I all of a sudden became a very political writer. So,
apologies.
And I'm not involved in any activism, but I've been teaching for the last 15 years, and for me that's as crucial. It's a slower process.
Yes.
It doesn't force change right away, but it's a space that's really important for me.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Madeline, your latest novel was shortlisted for the Man Booker Prize, and you've been nominated for and won a number of other literary prizes. Do these prizes mean you sell more copies of your books? It's said to be unusual for an author of literary works to make a living from her craft. Are you able to do so?
I am now, yeah. But I think all writers know that everything feels a bit precarious. And it's certainly true that you can have a book do well 1 year, and 5 years later, the book may sell 100 copies. It's just the nature of the vocation that we have. You know, we put everything into the kind of ways we're trying to represent reality or question the representations of reality around us. And sometimes it strikes a chord, and sometimes it's not its time. The Cambodia novel was never published in the United States until last year. And when I finished that book, my American editor just said, it's your best work by far, but there's no market for that book in the United States. And it was only published because of the success of Do Not Say We Have Nothing. But I have to say that when I got the, whatever it was, 50 rejection letters from American publishers for the earlier book, which is Dogs at the Perimeter, I felt very calm. I felt like, I felt this confidence that eventually the book would have its time. And we, I think, writers are playing this long game because we know that the questions we're asking, the politics we're confronting, recurs. We may feel like we're in a revolutionary moment, but certain structures are resisting all forms of change. And trying to see through how that's happening, how in thinking we're overthrowing something, we are replicating something else. And that, I think, is what literature is trying, you know, to... It's like we may be saying the same things over the centuries, but we're trying each time to say it in a new way so that it can be heard as if for the first time, so that it can really be felt once more. And it is a sort of never-ending challenge.
Okay, thank you. Rodrigo, Margaret, both of you are highly successful authors as well. Are you making enough money from your craft? Are you teaching or doing something else to get by?
I just feel so awkward. I mean, I don't even, my book just came out in August, so I have a long, this is a long game, as Madeline said, and I'm in it for the long haul, so mm-hmm. Yeah, we'll see how it continues to go.
No, far from it. I've never expected to make money with books. No, that writing is something else for me, and this is what I chose to do. But I wasn't at any point thinking, "Oh, I'll make a living out of this." So I do different things. I teach. I freelance for different journals or magazines. And a long, long list of small things. You know, I'm doing 100 different things. But I'm trying to buy myself time to write. So I think that's the important thing. I choose small things that won't take away all my time. So I wouldn't ever work at an office or have a full schedule. I'm doing this 100 different things, but I'm doing them, okay, I'll do this for an hour, and I'll do this for another hour, and then I'll have like 6 hours a day to focus on my writing.
So every one of the three of you sees this current novel that we're talking about here today as just one in a whole series of works, a lifetime of work that is your vocation. And perhaps in the long run, the sales will accumulate and you too will both be making a living from it. Maddie will go on to greater success with a future novel. It's interesting, when, as readers, we so often read an individual book and think of that as something in and something complete in itself, and don't think about the trajectory of a writer's career. Interesting. I hadn't really quite thought of it that way. So Margaret, back to you. A Kind of Freedom explores the Creole culture of Louisiana, the legacy of centuries of intermarriage between black and white, and the vestiges of French culture, at least as I see it. Is the experience of growing up in that unique environment different in substantive ways from growing up in a predominantly African-American community, say in Oakland or Chicago?
Yeah, I think it is. I mean, I only grew up there, so it's hard to say for sure, but... I think it is. I think when anybody goes to New Orleans, they can sense the magic of the place. It almost feels like you're in a different country. And so there was just, my childhood was just filled with so much culture. And I mean, everybody has that. And of course, black Americans have that all over the country. But it was really special. I mean, I think it was just a really special upbringing. We had, you know, at our bake sales, they would be selling pralines, and they would be selling pickles and potato chips, and, like, you know, everybody made red beans and rice on Monday, and Everybody would, we would be in the hair salon on Friday, and there would be these women coming in selling fried fish suppers, and the suppers would have like macaroni and cheese, peas, and fried fish, and that, and that's because we're all Catholic, and you know, it was just a very special, it was a very special upbringing, and it really helped, especially with the first book. It helped to be able to easily tap into such a rich community of information. Like, a lot of the details in this book I researched, of course, but a lot of them I simply remembered. And to be able to infuse the novel with all of that, with all of that history and like just the music of the language of New Orleans and just all of its culture, I could just sew that into the book. And It was almost like a freebie because I'm from there and it's my place, but it really amplifies a book anytime you have it taking place in a very rich community like that. It really amplifies it without you having to do much else. It speaks for itself. And New Orleans became a character in this book. And a lot of it is just, a lot of it is the way that I, you know, spoke about New Orleans in the book, but a lot of it is just, you know, inserting New Orleans anywhere, it has its own magic, so it'll just speak for itself.
Okay, thank you. Rodrigo, your translator wrote that, quote, the hazy line between fact and fiction comes up again and again in your writing. And that's certainly true in Affections, which is loosely based on the very very limited amount of information that has survived about the Ertel family. You've clearly taken a lot of liberties with the story, as you freely admit. Now, the modern meaning of fact is, quote, something collectively perceived to be true, right? While fiction is an imaginative creation or a pretense that doesn't represent reality but has been invented. In the era of fake news, this is an important distinction. But are you taking a philosophical position that there's really no difference?
It is an important distinction in the political arena and in journalism, but I don't think it's that important in literature. I think we should aim for truth and we should demand truth in our politicians, in our journalists, in our nonfiction writers. But it's not something I'm looking for when I'm reading a novel. I think literature deals more with emotions and less with facts, and it doesn't, literature, at least the literature I'm interested in, isn't making an argument. It's offering me ambiguous, complex stories. It's showing me how other people live. It's how other people understand themselves, how they relate to others. So that's really what I'm interested in.
Sure.
In literature. As an undergrad, I studied journalism, and one of the first exercises we had was to all write about something we saw together. For instance, right now I give you a paper to each one of you, and I tell you, okay, you have 15 minutes to describe what you've just seen in this panel. And each one of you would write something absolutely different, right? Mm-hmm. You've all been here, you've all witnessed the exact same thing, but in that act of writing, you're also transforming reality. In every word you choose, you're transforming reality. And then on the other hand, I really had little material, available materials when I was doing the research for this novel. So I knew some of the facts. I knew that the daughter was involved in the guerrilla movement in Bolivia, for instance, but I didn't know what happened in the night she got married, and I was as interested in that as in her involvement in the guerrilla movement. So I tried to be as truthful to the facts I had, but then I worked with the liberty of a fiction writer.
Fascinating. Maddie, in an interview with Granta in 2016, you stated that you're thinking about, quote, the way women's lives are expressed in literature at this moment. Given the emergence of the Me Too movement and the election of a sexual predator to the Oval Office, this can easily be considered a political choice. Do you think in those terms? I recognize that you're Canadian, but I'm sure most of your readers are American or British, and you do live here part of the year to teach. When you write, do you consider what's going on in the society around you, or like many other authors, are you writing strictly for yourself?
There's like 20 questions in that question. Okay, let me think. I think that distinction between self and the reader disintegrates a bit for me. I think that when I sit down and enter this world that I'm trying to see clearly, the feeling of self actually dissolves. So what I'm trying to do as much as humanly possible is to enter into the life history angle of vision, personhood of the character whose voice I'm sharing in that moment. And I think in the nature of the novel, you're looking at how truth, I think to follow up on something that Rodrigo was saying, how truth arises when these different truths come into contact with each other. And it's in the collision of those ideas that we may find what reality is or what a common reality might be. And it's only in the collision of many different kinds of novels or works or pieces of art that we're going to begin to piece together what that fabric looks like. Mm-hmm. So in that sense, you see, it's hard for me to dissolve political conditions, society, self, who we are within the conditions in which we're living. I think it's so incredibly inextricable. But maybe what we're trying to do is just see beyond the limited strip that we've been given in the very limited time that we have.
Okay, thank you. All right, I'm looking for short answers on this next question. It's for all three of you. Writing books can be considered an essentially optimistic act. After all, we hope that people are actually going to read the stuff that we write, and that they won't be distracted by some terrible political or economic crisis. As you're perfectly well aware, this country's recent history has brought an ugly reality to the surface. Many of us, particularly here in the Bay Area, are finding it increasingly difficult to be optimistic about the future. Viewing the American political scene today, are you optimistic that this wave of nativism and racism that our president has unleashed will prove to be short-lived?
short-lived. I wouldn't say I'm optimistic that it'll be short-lived, because I don't think that. And I don't think you were necessarily implying this, but I don't think that he brought it about, like he gave birth to it, and then it's having this life, and then it's going to die when he leaves. No. I mean, obviously, it's been there all along. And I think you'll find when you talk to a lot of people of color that we are less, far, far, far less surprised and traumatized by the events, because they don't shock us. Because in many ways, this is not, I don't feel that my life has changed. So, but having said that, I'm very optimistic, because I think almost because of that, because my life hasn't changed, because this doesn't strike me as so new. I mean, there are there are aspects of the administration that are startlingly and frighteningly new, but it's not the racial stuff. To me, that's been there, and the fact that it's been there, and it's, and I think it goes in patterns and waves. And Madeline, you talked about this. I mean, you think that this stuff is new, but you look back in history and this stuff has been going on forever. And I think, you know, you make progress and then you go back a little bit and then you make progress, and that's how we inch forward as a society. And I think we're going to move forward after this again. I don't think this is, I just don't think of it as so, you know, startlingly new, I guess. And so because of that, I'm optimistic.
Good. Great, that's encouraging. Rodrigo?
Yeah, I completely agree. I'm optimistic about the new forms of solidarity that this moment is creating. I'm optimistic about what I see in the streets. Well, whenever I turn on the TV or read the papers, I'm very pessimistic. But then I go walk around and I see things and I see an energy that makes me optimistic. And I'm also optimistic about the demographics. I think this the U.S. is experiencing a huge demographical change, so, and that makes me optimistic in some way.
Good. Thank you.
I also very much agree. You know, I think it's undeniably a very precarious time. Things can go in many different possible directions. When Trump announced his nomination, I said to my friends, he's going to win the presidency.
I said the same thing to my wife. I was like,
I was laughed at. I mean, I literally for 2 years, people laughed at me and just, you know, said the numbers, it's impossible, et cetera, et cetera. I was like, but pay attention to the moment we're living in, the kinds of what's happened with the sphere of media, what's happened to public and private space, how populism fits into all of this, the converging dynamics are leading to this man coming to power, we need to wake up to the kinds of conversations we're having. I think one of the interesting things is the political realignment around the world. It's very interesting in Asia because people have realized that American power is waning. It was already visible in Asia for a long time in the last decade. People are realizing they need to have different kinds of conversations because the power there now is China. And I think some of the difficult conversations that haven't happened are what is going to happen to some of these smaller countries, less powerful countries, countries that have been under dictatorship like Cambodia, that are now in China's sphere. Another thing that hasn't been talked about is what happens when the levels of surveillance that have been perfected in China in terms of internet surveillance, lack of ability to post anonymously, when those technologies are exported into all of our countries, and in fact where that those technologies are being developed in some of our countries and being used in China. And we are all implicated in each other's political realities, and I hope that what's happening in America is going to push us to have some of these different conversations where we realize we are all completely interdependent.
Thank you. Thank you all. I think I want to have plenty of time for questions, so let's start with that roving microphone, please. And who have we got who wants to ask a question? They're right in the middle there, a lady in the black with the blue scarf.
Let me sneak in here. When you're feeling personally passionate about a political horror or reality, how do you avoid making your novels didactic?
Well, I can just talk about it. I just talked to my husband about it. My husband is a master of storytelling, and he can, even talking to you, he can tell a really good story. And so a lot of times, I wrote a book before this one that never got published, but I worked on it for 4 years, and it took place in the Dominican Republic. And it wanted to preach a lot about the racial dynamics in the Dominican Republic, but there was no story there, and I didn't know that for a long time. And then once I got my husband on my team, it really expedites things. I can just say to him, I can just tell him, like, I'm thinking about a book, and then I'll just, like, describe what happened politically in the last week, and he'll say, yeah, but what's the story? And I'll and so I'll have to regroup. So that helps.
I was going to say that significant others are usually the most ruthless readers. Whenever I have a manuscript and I show it to my wife, I'm like trembling. And I know that I stick to emotions, I think. I stick to my characters, and not to ideas, but to not ideas, stories and emotions. And but it can become tricky, especially at this times that are so political. It's very easy to have that temptation and to become didactic. So that's my way.
I think what it gets down to is how that these ideas, you know, these ideas are persuasive. These ideas have an emotional and intellectual power that we can subscribe to, we can believe in, we can internalize it. And that's, I think, what the novel tries to get at the heart of. And part of the difficulty of writing, particularly the major part of the novel that's set during the Cultural Revolution. People think Cultural Revolution, they think, you know, tens of thousands of Red Guards in Tiananmen Square waving the little red book, a kind of cultish, as if the mind has been turned off, follower mentality. But what I wanted to get at is that how each and every one of us could have been persuaded by the power of this ideology, that it seemed to speak to the greatest social injustices of the age, that it offered a path for how to remake society, even if that meant destruction of everything that had come before, in order to sacrifice what must be sacrificed to bring about the new, which would be the good society, and how the rhetoric was very persuasive. And I think that is what I tried to get at, I'm sure I would have been persuaded. And that is something I had to confront within myself.
All right.
This is a great panel, by the way. Really thoughtful questions and eloquent answers by all the authors. Really, really enjoyable. Very quick question for Madeline. Back in 1997, I covered the Hong Kong handover from Great Britain to China, to Communist China, for the Examiner here in town. And the one of the stories was on free speech and free expression. And artists and writers that I interviewed had that famous Hong Kong optimism, but of course they were terrified that their lives and their work would be crushed. And they knew it would happen one day. It seems to be happening now. So can you talk a bit about the free speech, free expression issue in Hong Kong? And as it pertains to writing.
Transformation in Hong Kong has been swift. I think 5 years ago, or when Xi Jinping first came to power, I think many people watching thought that he was the first generation of the Cultural Revolution who was going into power, that he would that he might have a different path forward for China. Many people were mistaken. I think what terrifies me the most about what is happening in Hong Kong, which perhaps is related to art, writing, and our own societies, is the obliteration of the middle ground. That there is no space for the center in the public discourse, and the politics are driving people to extremes and to choose really particular kinds of sides that seem that they can have no converse with each other, and I think that is humanized in the person of Liu Xiaobo, who won the Nobel Prize and died in prison. Liu Xiaobo was a poet. He famously entered Tiananmen Square. He was there during the protests, the 6 weeks of protests. On the night that the tanks came in, he tried to be a go-between between the government and the students to find a way out. And he and some others of that older generation, that they were middle-aged at that point, were the ones who were able to create the conditions where the students could walk out of the square that night. And most people think the massacre happened in the square. The massacre happened in the streets leading to Tiananmen Square when parents, grandparents, high school students came out to stop the tanks from reaching the university students in the square. Liu Xiaobo, like many Chinese, asked only for the Chinese government to follow the constitution, to implement the rights that were already granted to Chinese citizens, to uphold the Chinese government's own law. And I think when we talk about civil rights movements, they were simply asking for equality before the law. And that is what the Chinese government would not withstand. And I think we may think that we're in a time of extremes, shouting down extremes, but I strongly feel we need to protect this middle space where divergent viewpoints can come into contact and find a path forward somehow. And it scares me that more and more people seem to think that this middle ground is a place of cowardice or a place that is not worth preserving.
Oh, okay. My question is for Rodrigo. I learned in a panel yesterday on Pablo Neruda that the primary influence in his political activism was the anti-fascist struggle in the Spanish Civil War. So as I am personally an author of a historical novel on the Spanish Civil War, I'm interested in how your upbringing in Bolivia was impacted by the events of, and the aftermath of the Spanish Civil War, the anti-fascist struggle there that may have then carried over into South America. So how did that play out in your life, Rodrigo?
Oh, thank you for the question. I think not at all. I was born in the 80s, and I mean, we were dealing with other stuff that was more immediate, for instance, dictatorships in my own country and the guerrilla movements. So I think that when I was growing up, that's what I was thinking about. That's what I was experiencing, and not anything related to Spain, which is a country that's really so far away from us, not only geographically but also mentally. I think even though we share the language, we think of Spain as part of Europe more than part of our own Latin American culture, right? So it wasn't present at all.
Okay. Madeline, I read your novel, Do Not Say We Have Nothing. And I have to say, in our book group, it evoked the most fascinating, deepest discussions we've had in 20 years because you covered so many issues so articulately, and yet you personified the issues. And you, each of your characters going through multiple generations, each one was almost like a painting. You really had a sense of what they embodied, what they look like, and how they lived. And I wondered how you chose the physical form and shape of the characters for the thoughts and the perspectives that you wish to address. And then, if we have time, I would be curious also how the other two authors chose their characters. But because I read your novel, and it was so compelling. I wonder how you did that. And did you have a sense of those generations first and who was going to be in them? Or did they evoke with the themes you wanted to share and the issues?
Thank you for the question. I wish I had an answer. You know, nothing, it's my fourth book, nothing, I'd never experienced anything like writing this novel. I think I thought I was writing my normal length, a 200-page novel, which I thought would be about the Tiananmen demonstrations. and what ended up was a 500-page epic of 20th century China, because those characters entered and refused to leave. And they took over my life. And they, it's funny when you say that, you know, to talk about the physical, because it's almost like they broke down my resistance even to the way I had been, they broke down my resistance to seeing. I do not normally write the way I wrote in this novel. And maybe it was being so humbled by all the months I spent trying to find my way through China, being confronted at every turn by things I didn't understand, and also realizing that if any country had lived something that we might call Dickensian, surely it was this country, the rises in fortune, the reversals, the transformations, the you know, the movement of the laborers to the cities is considered the largest migration in human history, and that happened in China in our lifetimes. That, I think, is what made its imprint on me. So that's what I'm saying I can't answer so well, because it was like I just was trying to see something. Yeah.
Okay. Would you mind if we just go on to the next question?
Sure.
No. Okay. Here, second row.
Okay, thank you. Kudos to the panel, to the moderator. It's been a really great panel and discussion. I have read Margaret's book and really, really enjoyed it. I like the way you cover the different generations. It meant that I could relate to Grandma as well as to some of the other characters. But what I was interested in, and I'm going to ask this of Margaret, if there's enough time, the other two panelists can answer. How did you come up with your title? I have some guesses, but I wonder, A Kind of Freedom. How did you get there? What was the process? Did the publisher sort of push that on you, or was it something kind of a compromise? And the same question for the other two authors. Thank you.
Thank you for the question and for reading. So when I left my, I used to work at a law firm. I left my job and I was on this trip and I was reading this Edward P. Jones book, All Aunt Hagar's Children. And I came across that phrase in one of the stories. And he was talking about how the descendants of slaves could only really possess a kind of freedom, you know, because of what they had inherited psychologically, et cetera. Through their bloodline. And so I mentioned that I wrote a book before this one that was about the Dominican Republic, and it was about a girl from New Orleans who went to the Dominican Republic to help this struggling community, but the racial dynamics in the country reminded her so thoroughly of what she had experienced in New Orleans that she ended up harming the community before she left. And I used this title for that book. That's what the name of that book was, A Kind of Freedom. And the name of this book was Early in the Morning. And it was, Early in the Morning, why was it? Oh, you know what I liked about that? And I even ended the book like that. It's like, you know, you have your idea for how the day is going to go. And I feel like Evelyn in this book has her idea for how her life is going to go and for how the generations beyond her are going to live. And it's obviously not that way. And so that was my, I was really happy with that title, but the publisher could never remember it. He would be like, you know, late at night or like early, right before nightfall. It was always these like, it's always these derivations of the title. He couldn't remember it. And finally we were like, this is not good that nobody can remember this title. And so we played with a lot of other titles, and one idea was to do a Creole title, and we just had a lot of different ideas. And then I thought, you know, A Kind of Freedom is really this book. It was never applicable to the Dominican book at all. And this, I really feel like this exemplifies what's happening here, how, you know, you have these descendants of slaves, and it's the structures of oppression are just traveling down with them, and so they can't quite get free. And it's a kind of freedom, and a sort of kind of freedom. And so, yeah, so that's how that came about.
It's one of the best book titles I've come across recently.
Thank you.
Yeah. Okay. Here.
I'm kind of starstruck. So, yeah. But this is actually related to your question. I'm not going to cry. You know, in choosing, how did the characters come to you? But how did you choose the moment you wanted to talk about? Because you can write about truth in sci-fi, you know, but you chose a specific political moment to write about. So what drew you to that moment for your story?
Well, in my case, I knew I wanted to write about this family, right? And the question you're asking was crucial. When should I start my story? Their lives are there. Where should I start? And mm-hmm. I wrote a lot before finding the real beginning. So, for instance, I wrote some chapters that were set in the Second World War and in Germany when they were still living there. Then I wrote about them traveling to South America, and I wrote about them starting their new lives there. And I did that for months until I found the real moment I was interested in, and that's when they're already living their lives there and getting involved in the history of this new country. So. I think it is a crucial question for any writer. Where do I start, and also where do I finish? If you choose those two moments well, I think you're almost all set. I think that's one of the most difficult questions.
Go ahead if you like.
For me, that's such a great question. For me. I grew up with a little cousin who was like a brother to me, and we ended up. I moved to Connecticut, and he stayed in New Orleans, and we were always close. But you know, we went in different directions. And the moment I think I realized I had this book in me was when I was being sworn into the bar. He was going to jail for the first time, and I just thought, what happened here? Like, my grandfather is a college graduate, and. And that's notable because of what we know about history. And so I just thought, what happened here? My grandfather, you know, was pre-med, and he didn't end up becoming a doctor, but he was pre-med, and how did this happen? And it's not just my family, you see it, you know? And so I started looking into why that might have happened, and I saw that it was relatively common for that kind of thing to happen, And I just knew I had to. So it was like these three points of, you know, like the grandfather being a doctor, and you know, the younger generation, you know, doing something else. And so I just wanted. And so really, the issue was, how do I tie in the middle? I really struggled with how to get the middle, but I knew from the beginning that I had those two points.
I think. You know, I thought I was writing about student protests. That's what I thought. I wanted to write about solidarity, power, revolution, and I ended up writing something quite different. And I was really, really wanted to look at that difference between what it means to be 20 and to stand in Tiananmen Square and confront the government, and what it might be to be a 50-year-old father who has lived through Mao's revolutions, who has lived through a time in which 60 million Chinese people died needlessly as a result of politics, and what it's like for that man to come into the street and face the tanks. And I wanted to put those two experiences side by side because I thought together they might show us what change actually might look like.
Okay. We have time for one more question for one author.
Hi, this is a question for Madeline, and you had mentioned that they said there was no market for your book Dogs of the Perimeter in the US, and I just want to understand what that actually means. Like, what are they saying, that US readers don't care or can't empathize with people from a place? What is the meaning of that statement? And I want to say that I think it's wrong. And yesterday I got to hear Viet Thanh Nguyen talk, and he had been rejected by 13 out of 14 publishers, and there clearly is a readership. So what are they saying, and what could you, you know, what light could you shed on that?
The full response was there was no market for it and that the Cambodia story had already been told. Of course, which I completely disagree with, of course. And I will say that with Do Not Say We Have Nothing, it was also rejected by, it must be 40-something U.S. publishers.
40.
Until it was longlisted for the Booker Prize, and at that point, only one U.S. publisher was willing to publish it.
Wow.
There I was told it was too ambitious, that nobody wanted to read in that much detail about China.
Good God.
And what I think is interesting is how much capital and centers of power are shaping the representations of reality that we come across in art. Mm. Because I think there's clearly a readership, clearly a market. And I struggle over the term market, but I just think we want to talk to each other. That's what it's really about. We want to be in contact with each other. And I think we have a lot of patience. You know, we're going to keep putting the work out there. We have no control, really, over what happens to it, but we believe that we must be in contact with one another.
Okay, I think it's time to wrap this up. I don't know about you, but I've enjoyed this a great deal. Thank you very much. Thank you to all our panelists. Thank you. I want to close on with two things. First, I want to acknowledge once again the sponsorship of the Canadian Consulate General of San Francisco and Silicon Valley. And I want to put in a plug for my own blog, which is a book review blog where I have posted more than 1,000 book reviews, and I will soon be reviewing all of these three books. So I invite you to join it. Mal Warwick on Books. Thank you. Thank you very much for coming.
We hope you enjoyed this podcast from the 2018 Bay Area Book Festival. For more podcasts, please go to www.baybookfest.org.